Welcome to The Apartment Guys, where we discuss all things apartment investing related, including how to find cash flowing apartments and raise capital. Join us every week for a high level discussion and interviews that will take your investing to the next level. Now, here are your hosts, The Apartment Guys, John Prince and Tate Seamer.
Welcome back to another episode of The Apartment Guys. Today we are so excited to have Mr. Paul Winterode with us today. He is a capital advisor and is based here in Salt Lake City, Utah, but works nationally with literally hundreds of sources of funding and programs from Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, CMBS, life insurance company, portfolios, private capital, etc. Paul, if it's out there, Paul has access to it. Paul grew up in Utah and went to the University of Utah, where he was captain of the golf team. And John and I are a little jelly of that.
Scratch golfer over here.
Yeah. That's right.
How nice would that be?
Be amazing.
Man. And then went to BYU in graduate school. And today works with multifamily commercial clients specifically. And brings together all those different program sources. So, Paul, welcome.
Thanks. Appreciate you being here, John. Very excited to be here. Excited to wrap with you guys today a little bit.
Awesome. So, yeah. So, a capital advisor. You know, in the past, we've used the term broker to describe essentially what you do, and of course, there's the term lender, which is something distinct from those things. Can you kind of explain the role of a capital advisor?
It's a good question. It's all about branding, you know, so I'm just trying to make myself sound important. But really that is my role, is to help people secure the right capital, specifically in debt for their projects. I specialize in placing debt, multifamily assets, $1 million and above of all sorts, as you mentioned. And there is a lot of lingo and verbiage in commercial real estate in different names. Certainly refer to myself as well as a mortgage broker, a loan officer. That encompasses what I do. Our firm isn't a lender per se. We work with a number of different lenders. And so an easy way to understand, what is a lender? What's the difference? You go to your local bank or credit union, and they have funds that they put out and lend and charge interest for that. They have their particular set of programs. They have their underwriting flavor. And you go to that bank or credit union and you get what they offer, their rate and terms. Mm-hmm. And so not all lenders are created equal. And there's a lot of different types of investments and strategies and needs and markets where different lenders are going to perform better than others. And so I make it my business to understand who offers what. And so when you have a deal, you can come to me. I can go, hey, I understand what it is, what you need. There's maybe a dozen or so lenders that are going to have a potential interest in that. I'll put together a package in a way that the lenders are going to understand it and want the deal, present you in the best light. I'm a filter. I'm not the end user. So you can be candid and honest and open, and we can work through challenges and maybe weaknesses and make it look good, get that ready, ship it out. And then I work in your behalf to negotiate with those lenders and really create a mini market where get them competing for your business. And I become a single point of contact for you. So the idea is to save you time and also make the process smoother for you as well.
Yeah, and full disclosure, we just went through a process with Paul where we had a deal that was very specific in terms of its needs. It was a heavy value add deal or repositioning, if you want to call it that, where the place was 50% vacant, needed $2 million worth of work. That's only going to appeal to a certain type of investor, right, Paul?
Yeah.
So we packaged that up, or Paul packaged that up and got that in front of some lenders and got that going down the road. And that deal didn't materialize for for a number of reasons. Mainly, the big reason was that we got outbid.
Yeah.
So,
well, you can't recover from overpaying that well in this game. So.
Right.
Yeah. It's good to be disciplined.
So, but we're all good about that. And yeah, it was a great learning experience for us because we got front seat view of what's needed to put a deal together. And in this space, you're finding deals, you're finding dollars, you're putting them together, and you're adding value to properties and in residents' lives, and therefore increasing value of assets and cash flow, building wealth and passive income, right? So talk to us a little bit about like so we find our first deal. Somebody, a listener out there, finds their first deal and it's a good one, right? And they've got the equity, it pencils really well. They bring it to you, you look at it and wow, this is a good one. This has legs for sure. What happens from there? What do you need? What are you looking for from that point forward?
Right. In order for me to review a deal and underwrite it, I simply need a current rent roll and a trailing 12-month operating statement or P&L. And we really like to see the month by month broken out so we can see when taxes were paid, if there's any seasonality, ebbs and flows there. But if we have that, we can start underwriting the deal and give that initial take. Hey, is there something here, or is it going to work? And I always say there's always a loan out there. You may not like it, whether it's a good or bad deal per se. We can find something. But there's three things we're looking for as far as passing through the doorway of qualifying for a loan from a credit perspective. First thing, we want to see a nice credit score, minimum of 650. If we're starting with a 7, we're much better off. It's not like residential mortgages where there's this big matrix and your pricing is based on your credit score. We want to see a nice credit history. Second thing is net worth. We like to see net worth equal to the loan amount. So $2 million property, we want to, and let's say it's a 75% loan to value, that'd be $1.5 million. We'd like to see net worth equal to the loan amount. Mm-hmm. And people might think, hey, that may be a lot, or I don't have that. That's why we commonly see partnerships and two or three individuals coming together, and collectively they qualify mm-hmm. for that net worth mm-hmm. requirement. So it doesn't just have to be one individual. It has to be a group of the signers mm-hmm. of the loan.
Now, Paul, quick question on that. So let's say you've got four people in a GP coming together on, you know, some sort of apartment syndication. Mm-hmm. And let's say two of them are really solid and meet that criteria. But the other two are almost in the opposite direction. Everything about those three criteria is bad for them. Now, does it matter that there's two in the group that have, you know, bad credit, bad net worth, or is it only matter that there was two that meet the requirement?
If it's bad or adverse and it's dragging the deal down, we just leave them out. We just would leave them off the loan. If they're neutral or add a little value, may not need them, I would recommend getting on that loan as that investor simply to start building your experience and credibility and, mm-hmm. and resume of loans that you've been a part of and repaid successfully for future deals. So if you can get on the loan, I would recommend it.
But you probably need to be in at least a neutral status on those criteria.
Correct. If you've got a bankruptcy and a 500 credit score,
you're getting left off the loan.
We'll leave you off. We'll keep it. We'll make it simpler on not doing letters of explanation and all that.
Yeah. Sure. Yes.
So we've got net worth, liquidity.
Well, liquidity, we didn't really talk about.
Right. Okay.
But that is the third thing here. Okay. So liquidity, what we mean is cash on hand after your down payment or after your equity requirement. We like to see that. It's nice if we can keep it at 10% of the loan amount following that same example. That'd be $150,000 on that $1.5 million loan. Now, a lot of loans require technically less, especially under loans under $10 million. Standard for Fannie and Freddie is 9 months principal and interest payments. So okay. You can do the math, and with interest rates low, it may be 100,000 or 110. I'm just spitballing. Here are some numbers, but but there is a usually a liquidity requirement, and the more you have, the better. That can tip the scales in your favor if you're very liquid. Lenders like to see, hey, there's a rainy day fund. If there's problems, there's funds to draw upon, rather than if the roof blows off,
right?
Insurance struggles. There's, you know,
reserves.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
That'd be problematic.
Right.
Do you see a way, Paul, you know, I've heard before that it's really important the way you package all this information up when you're handing it off, you know, either to yourself. So do you help someone that's coming to you say, hey, you know, we need to package this up a little bit better. We need to put a little more polish on it before we actually send it to the lender. Or is that something that they need to be doing before they send it to you?
Yeah.
You
know? It's really a collaborative process. So there's some information I just don't know as far as history and numbers and that sort of thing. So I certainly need the borrowers to participate and share that information, but we're going to package it in a way that's easily digestible by lenders and offer suggestions. I just wrote an article or an email newsletter about the importance of a real estate resume. It's not a commonly requested tool. However, if you can have that document that spells out who you are, what you're about, what you've done, why you're essentially mitigating risk for a lender, that's very useful, because not only am I going to review the package, but there's an analyst and an underwriting team and a loan committee. And so, you know, your file can get in front of 10, 12, 15 people with one lender, potentially more. And if you're, when we're shopping it, that's multiple lenders. So that real estate resume is a chance for you to really sell yourself in a way that's putting your best foot forward, and that you just don't have access to share that story with people. So that's a great arrow to have in your quiver and to have to provide to lenders. And another common item that we ask for that dribbles in is a strong pro forma. Again, if you look at a lender, they think in terms of risk. That's what it is. How do we mitigate risk? How do we know that we're going to make, basically get their money back? And so having a detailed, well thought out pro forma on how you will operate the property and what it will do is certainly going to help make it look better, like you know what you're doing and you have answers to that questions. We do look at historical performance for underwriting for the loan, but it's always sweetened if we can say, hey, this is where we're going and here's what it'll look like.
Sure. Now, do people typically use a professional company to write up and help them with their performas? Or, you know, do you have anyone that you know that does that you'd recommend? Or, you know, how do you see the most effective way of doing that generally?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's several, you can get on Google, there's lots of gurus that have their spreadsheets. You can buy some very sophisticated spreadsheets for underwriting. I think they're all good tools. The trick, though, the more detailed you get, the harder they are to understand, and you may be missing something. And not everyone needs to be an Excel whiz in this business, but the more you can understand Excel and how to build a spreadsheet and build your own pro forma is going to help you in the business. So I think there's probably a certain point where it may make sense to outsource some underwriting, but starting out, I would definitely say even building your own spreadsheet and underwriting, using that spreadsheet so you know all the inputs and everything that's in there is the right way to go.
That's great stuff. And underwriting is something that we'll spend so many episodes talking about, hitting on, because it's such an in-depth topic and it's so important in this process, right? And you're finding deals, finding dollars, and then you're underwriting it to make sure that you can put them together in a way that makes sense. So I have a quick question for you. Can you underwrite our deals?
by definition, we do. So
yeah, no, we, I, I, we're just getting to a point. We're seeing we're seeing 3 to 5 deals a week, 2 to 5 deals a week that we feel are worth digging into, and so it's a load on me right now. So anyway, that's a different conversation.
Real quick though, before we move on from that, I have one more question about that. So when you were talking about that, you were saying less detail, almost less is more. Is that what you're saying on these performers? Don't overkill as far as drilling into every line item.
Or I do want to clarify that. I think it needs to be robust enough that you've thought it out. There probably is an inflection point where it becomes too convoluted and it's not necessarily scalable. So I've seen some very detailed and complex pro formas and spreadsheets that are obviously going to provide the best possible information, but is it practical to spend 10 hours per deal if you're looking at 5 deals a week? No. So
yeah, sure.
If it's a handful of inputs, that's not enough. If it's 1,000 inputs, it's probably too much to be practical. It's not a definitive answer, but
no, yeah, that makes sense.
There is a sweet spot there.
So Paul, as people are breaking into this multifamily space, and you were talking about having arrows in your quiver earlier, you know, for us as apartment syndicators, for Carl, my partner, and myself, we consider you an arrow in our quiver. In fact, a very important one, because when we're out trying to secure deals and do acquisitions, man, it's so much on you, especially once they're under contract, right? But even before the contract, you're such a key part of the process from what we've found in just winning a deal, like presenting the sponsorship team in such a way that they're going to win a deal and get the contract if they're in a competitive situation. So, you hear people talk about building a power team when you're new, right? Your attorneys, your agents, your brokers, your property managers, your title company, as a capital advisor, as a mortgage broker, however you want to frame it, talk about your role in terms of getting somebody kind of started in the business, how you can help them understand all the steps they need to take to make sure that they're ready when the right situation comes up.
Yeah. And there's a ton to learn in this business. That's one of the things I love about it. There's always another level and layer and something new to learn. And it's dynamic and changing as longstanding as an industry of housing may be. There's always something new to figure out. And so having that mindset of always learning, I think, is a great foundation. There's a lot of information online. This podcast is great. You know, when you're driving to work, listen to a podcast. Yep. Stay in tune, right? But there's certain things you can do to get prepared, and we've touched upon them a little bit, but having a personal financial statement and schedule of real estate that you've built, you have ready. I think the first year of actually doing that, it's really beneficial to do it every month. I've gone through that process. Now I update mine quarterly. But it's fun to even have a record to see, hey, this used to be X and now it's Y. And just monitoring things like that is helpful. So I've got a template. I'll give people my email. I can send that out. But it's a 3 worksheet, personal financial statement, walks you through all the things that you include, sums it up, puts it in one sheet, and also has a schedule of real estate so you can sell your your real estate.
We'll put that in the show notes too.
It's probably a bit of an ego check too.
Yeah.
going through that process, you know.
Or an ego booster, depending on how it turns
out. No, but I think it is a healthy exercise because there's a lot of, you know, there's all the people we know that are, you know, investing and flipping. How often do we actually take the time to see what our net worth is or where our personal balance sheet is,
that sort of thing. So
yeah,
I'm going to have that. We're going to have to fill it out anyway. Mm-hmm. So why not have it ready? Yeah. When you've got a deal, you've got a million things to do. So prepare that in advance. We talked about the real estate resume. The network, of course, is important. Excuse me. One thing you touched upon, which can be be daunting is, well, how do we qualify for this loan? Say you say I have to have this net worth equal to a loan amount. I found a $5 million deal. I'm not even close. Well, part of that, if you syndicate, really that's the solution. And part of your general partnership can be a key principal, someone that comes in with the net worth, the liquidity, and the experience doing those loans that will work with the team, will certainly provide insight, and you can figure out what that negotiation looks like and how that's structured. But we have individuals. I've introduced people that have, you know, made deals happen that way, because there's someone that's boots on the street and someone that has the financial qualifications that can make it happen. And so being open to that and realizing, hey, maybe this is the price of admission on the first deal or two. Well, I don't want to give that up. Well, we've all said it, we've all heard it, but 100% of nothing is still nothing. I'd rather have 5% of something, well, right?
Yeah, we'd rather have, Carl and I, our philosophies, we'd rather have a slice of a watermelon than a grape, right?
Yeah. Same. Great analogy.
Same thing. Yeah.
So, Paul, one question I have is, you know, my partner and I, as we've done various development deals, you know, he's always talking about, hey, let's go try and find a non-recourse loan. And it's kind of this almost like mythological thing, this non-recourse loan, and you go to everyone and everyone wants recourse. And so I don't know if you can speak to that just a little bit. You know, how does one actually, obviously non-recourse is going to be desirable on deals if you can get it. What does it take for someone to get a non-recourse loan?
Yeah. So I always advise my clients to go the non-recourse route whenever they can. And just to define it, if anyone is unfamiliar with those terms, your typical banks and credit unions are recourse lenders. That's what we're most familiar with and common with. And recourse means you're signing an unlimited personal guarantee. Your house, your boat, your cars, your kids. I jest a little, but
dog.
Basically everything that you have, you're signing over to that loan in the event of default. And the flip side, the non-recourse, is simply the asset is the collateral. So if you go into default, it's foreclosed, you lose the property, all you lose is the equity. They're not coming after you personally for any assets there. So if you want to grow, if you want to scale, there's a limit of how much you can be on the hook for on a personal guarantee basis, where lenders at some point will just say, hey, this is too much, we can't do it. So you really need to get into that non-recourse space, and certainly talk to a lot of first-time investors that are interested in that and want that. And it's tough to get as a first-time investor. Usually how you cut your teeth is in that recourse space. You're working with a bank because they're typically close to the property. They can get familiar with it. They're more community-based, if you will. And they're willing to take that risk because they know that they can come after the assets, and that's how it works. And so
yeah,
that's where you start. That's where I started in the game on my own investing.
And so experience is essentially probably the driving key factor between if you're going to get a recourse versus non-recourse loan.
Correct. So once we get into Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, that would be the next progression there. They'll do $1 million loans and above on a non-recourse basis. What they're looking for from an experience standpoint is 2 years of ownership of a like-kind asset. So 2 years of, if multifamily is what we're looking at, that would be the case. And that, or ownership of two properties for a year. It is a bit of a gray area where the net worth and liquidity are black and white. It's either yes or no. The experience is a little more gray. Some mitigants are a stellar property management group, like best of class, not just some Joe Schmo, but a real strong property manager, and also proximity to the property. If you as an owner live near to the property, have a great property manager, those are some potential workarounds. But if I've worked on deals where new investors, out-of-state property, like California investors looking in Georgia. It just didn't fly. It was too far away. It was too nebulous. So those are some workarounds.
Is it possible to make up for the lack of experience with, you know, going above and beyond with net worth and liquidity and those factors? I mean, let's say your first deal, but you have someone on your GP that is a part of the deal that is just, you know, their net worth, liquidity, all the other factors are through the roof, way more than what would be expected. Could that overcome the fact that there's a lack of experience and allow you to get a non-recourse loan?
That would help. I would assume that that strong borrower would likely have some real estate.
Sure.
And some experience there. Not all wealth is generated from real estate. A lot is. So that would be an outlier type scenario. But
sure.
It when there is that strength, that certainly can make a difference. That's more of the story and the art of it rather than the law. And that's why I say it's a bit of a gray area. But that could be a workaround.
Sure.
Paul, one of the really important key parts of winning a bid in a competitive situation, you can tell this is fresh on my mind.
We
just got done working on a 187 unit deal in San Antonio that we were up against three other bids, and so we know this situation really well. Talk about the power of a term sheet. What is a term sheet, and what does that show the seller? And why would you want that in place?
Yeah. As we discovered and worked through, it is a bit of a chicken and an egg scenario. Yeah. Definitionally, a term sheet is a document you'll receive from a lender outlining the terms of the loan that they're proposing. So they've underwritten the deal. They've typically run it up the flagpole to get approval internally, at least a soft approval of what that lender can offer, and they put it in writing and say, here's what we can do. Here are the terms and conditions. It's subject to appraisal and underwriting and so forth. And usually in order to accept that term sheet and go under application with the deal, there's a deposit, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, depending on the deal and the size, to cover the underwriting costs and to show commitment.
Is that, if the deal doesn't materialize, that's a cost of due diligence, essentially.
Correct.
At that point.
Correct.
Yep. Okay.
But we're spending money once we start that. We're ordering appraisals. We've got site inspections. There's legal work. So some of that can be recouped if it's stopped early on in the process. But typically, we don't produce that term sheet or really go under loan application until you're under PSA. With the property, you have control of buying that property, and a lot of lenders don't even want to look at deals or get to that term sheet phase unless you do have control, because there is legwork and time involved.
So a PSA is a purchase sales agreement,
correct?
And that's essentially the document that gives you contractual control over the property and puts you under official contract with the seller, right? So okay, so maybe it's unreasonable for us as buyers to expect to be able to pull off getting a term sheet put together with a LOI, for instance. Those things, a letter of intent, which typically comes before a PSA in the process. Those things kind of come at two different points in the process. So what, you know, as buyers, what can we do? How can we work together, you know, as capital advisor and investor, to put together the strongest looking case for us being the buyer that the seller should go with?
Yeah, it is a process, and the earlier we start, the better. Certainly, I like to know if you're looking at a property, if you're seriously looking at it, as we did. It makes sense to get the rent roll, get operating statements, and do some underwriting and say, hey, here's the outline of terms, and get different lenders interested. Mm-hmm. And so one thing that comes to mind that we haven't touched upon yet in our conversation is, well, we've touched upon the team, but lenders refer to it as your org structure, your organizational structure, or an org sheet. That's really your ownership mm-hmm. structure. And I understand that can be somewhat fluid as different partners may come into different deals, but mm-hmm. understanding who the ownership is, what percentages, who's really going to own the deal is going to be critical for the lenders to underwrite that. So the sooner you can solidify that team and that structure, the easier it will be for the lender to wrap their head around it, see if it's the right credit risk for mm-hmm. them, and then also we'll gather the right documentation from the right people.
And this can all be done without a deal in the works.
Sure. Even,
just to be ready to pull the trigger when something pops sure. up. Yeah. That's a great takeaway, guys. If you're serious, and this is a hot market, it's super competitive, and deals often go to multiple offers, even off market deals go to multiple offers in this market. So you want to be as competitive as you possibly can, and your lender can be a really big part of that. Another item that can make your offer really stand out, your LOI really stand out, is proof of funds. We won't get into that today because that's an equity piece, but just something else that can sweeten an offer.
You know,
something like that.
So just to interject here, Tate, being prepared really gives you a leg up in mm-hmm. the process, especially if you need to close quick. So if we're doing a bridge loan, 30 to 45 days. If we're doing typical permanent financing, 45 to 60. It may even spill over a little bit. There's a lot of activity in the space right now. Lenders are busy. Mm-hmm. So that 30 or 60 day window that we have is really from that application piece. And so I'll get asked, how long does it take to get done? And I'll say that. That's what sticks in their mind. But no, there is usually a week on the shortest end to 3 weeks to figure out what we're doing. I got to get the documentation. I've got to underwrite it, put it together, work with lenders, go back and forth, put that together so you can make a decision. So if you're relying on me to say, Tate, John, I need this document, then you got to go create it or produce it. That's just going to slow down the process. That's where we get into that 3 week mm-hmm. window. But if you're prepared with some of these items, you can be like, hey, we found it. Here's everything you need, Paul, or whoever you're working with. Mm-hmm. We're off to the races. That can shave a couple weeks off the process for you.
And a couple weeks in this business can be everything.
Yeah.
That's huge. That's good stuff.
And again, just to recap that, you know, everything that you need part of it to get to you, that's trailing 12 month, that's current income statement, that's what?
Rent roll.
Personal financials, what else would be involved in that? You know, everything you need for that and to get that application.
The organization structure, who the ownership team is, the pro forma, and ideally resumes of the key principals signing on the loan.
How often do people get all that to you when they...
Well, eventually. They all.
How often do they get all that to you
the ones that close
on the first go around?
For that to show up on my desk right away is quite rare.
Gotcha.
So
quick question, and this, you know, we've talked about all this, but I'm just curious how you would put this. You know, let's say you're talking to a young person that wants to break into the multifamily space. Maybe they're a flipper, maybe they've been doing some wholesaling and they're ready to, you know, take on that, but they don't have the net worth, they don't have the liquidity, they don't have the credit, you know, or maybe they're borderline credit. You know, what is the most important thing you would tell them? What would you say to them, you know, as far as getting started? Just try and surround yourself with those that do have, you know, high net worth individuals, or, you know, kind of what advice would you give to someone in that situation?
Yeah. If they truly are serious about it, I would make their primary source of income that they need to live off today somewhere in the industry, whether it's at a lender, even better, a property manager. I think property management is a great way to cut your teeth and understand what's going on and seeing units, seeing what interaction with tenants are. I think that's the best way to wrap your head around it and then network like crazy. And being in the business will accelerate it greatly.
Because likely that person is going to have to have someone with high net worth support them on their first couple of deals.
Yeah.
Be the sponsor. Be
before you're the clients you work with, if you're a property manager or owners, well,
high net worth individuals.
Yeah. Most owners that I work with, they want more. They've tasted the fruit and they want to keep going. So yeah,
that's good stuff, Paul. So just to kind of bring it back to, you know, we as entrepreneurs love talking shop and, you know, like to get to know each other in terms of what makes each other tick and what books we're reading, that sort of thing. Kind of share with us, you know, if you don't mind, a little bit about what drives Paul Winterode. Like, you know, what lights you up? Why do you do what you do inside of the multifamily space? And you know, what's the big picture for Paul Winterode?
Yeah. Well, thanks for asking. I've always had a latent interest, if you will, in real estate. It was always interesting to me, and it took me a few years to find it. But there's so many things that I like about it, and I'm really passionate about regarding real estate on a very foundational level. I believe one of our most important core needs as human beings is shelter. Mm-hmm. And in this business, we're providing shelter. We're providing someone's home. Where someone lives, we become numb to it, but it's extremely important to our well-being. And so being part of providing good, safe, clean, responsible housing is just rewarding to me at a fundamental level. Moving up the food chain, if you will, and I know we're recording this, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I have big issue with big government taxes. Mm-hmm. I won't wax political, but the government has set up tax laws such that they said, hey, if you're providing housing, you don't have to give us as much money as other sources of income. And right. So real estate is another great way to retain your dollars and to pay less dollars in tax. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's appealing. Mm-hmm. I think Main Street, the Main Street investors, you and I, the mom and pop, are far more responsible and better fiduciaries than those on Wall Street. Mm-hmm. I think Wall Street is also corrupt. Not everyone there is, but there's a lot of self-interest. And we look at the financial debacle of 2008, and we can point the finger at mm-hmm. Wall Street. Sure. There's books and movies about this. Absolutely. But the more money we can get out of Wall Street and onto Main Street, the better I think we all are as operators, as well as investors.
Yeah, and you know what you're really speaking to is the magic of multifamily and specifically passive investing, right? As an alternative to the stock market,
yeah.
Where you know stock market at you know at best you know 7%, 8-6 somewhere in there, right?
Yeah, but you can lose 15 in a heartbeat, and then you got to make 35 to get back to where you were.
And you have nothing to show. Yeah. Even if you do lose 15, you're still holding a piece of paper. Like you said, Paul, we're providing a basic human need, and everybody needs it in the form of housing. And the specific space that we work in is affordable, more affordable apartment
workforce housing.
Yeah, C, class C plus, class B minus, B plus, or B, right? So that level of product just is becoming more and more scarce because they're not building more of that, right?
No, you can't.
So we feel so strongly about this asset class as a wonderful place to put your money, you know, and we can talk about that, you know, and we'll talk about it at length because it's so compelling and so exciting, the upside of specifically commercial multifamily real estate that's both cash flowing and appreciating, and you're getting the tax advantage of the depreciation. You're paying down principal. Your tenants are paying down your principal. Rents are going up. There's so many fun, amazing things about it, and I will
leverage
is huge. I mean, that Absolutely.
Yeah.
We love the way you're talking to us right now. We invite you back and let you give you the mic for a full hour on that.
Yeah. So a couple of questions that we like to ask all of our guests, Paul. If you could go back, how long have you been in a capital advisor, mortgage broker?
5 years now.
That's perfect. So I was just about to ask you, if you could go back and talk to yourself 5 years ago, what would you tell yourself?
I'd tell it to myself. I tell it to friends, family. The best time to buy real estate was 20 years ago. The second best time is today.
Mm-hmm.
Get in the game. I've talked to hundreds of different people in this business, and a lot of people trying to break in and finding out about loans. I see a much smaller percentage actually take action, and those that do have dramatically improved and changed their lives. It hasn't been easy for them, but actually getting in the game, finding a way to be in the arena, mm-hmm. if you will, is the best advice I can give, no matter how you find it. Don't overanalyze, don't study it out forever. Don't be stupid, but get in the game. Like there's so many gurus out there that are selling $20,000, $30,000, $50,000, $100,000 training packages. Well, I guarantee you'll learn a heck of a lot more losing $50,000 on a deal than you will from that guru.
That is so true.
Oh boy. Do we know that one? That's perfect. So yeah. So get in the game. We know that you out there listening to this are either in the game or busting into the game. That's why we are doing this podcast, is to help you get to that next level, get to the breakthrough, so that you are building the cash flow that you want to be financially free, financially independent, and building the wealth that will allow you to retire at age 40 or 35 or 50 or 55 or whatever your personal goal is. We look at it as, you know, 5 years to freedom. You know, do one big commercial multifamily deal a year for 5 years, boom, you're done.
Yeah.
Even do one big commercial deal, and that is a lot, that could be a life-changing.
It will change your life.
You know, event.
Yeah. Okay, so what's Paul Winterode life look like in 5 years from now? What are you doing on a day-to-day basis?
I'm doing the same thing I'm doing now. I love what I do. I'm excited about growing my business, continuing to build my business, both as a capital advisor and also as an investor. I love to be, I'm an LP, I'm a passive investor in deals. I love that.
Yep.
I'm a GP in a couple deals. It's a lot of work, and that's been very rewarding. But one of my core principles, I've shared this with a few people, is came from when I learned Japanese. Well, I learned a Japanese word, and that's Kaizen. I don't know all of Japanese, but it's a principle of continuous improvement. And so that's really exciting to me, to how can I be just a little bit better today than I was yesterday? And what I love about commercial real estate, the multifamily business, there's always something new. I get dozens of newsletters, and there's always articles, there's new strategies, there's different financing. The market evolves. There's always something there. So you look me up in 5 years, I'm still going to be doing this. Hopefully I'm 5 years better at it than I am today.
And just to speak to something that we maybe could have mentioned earlier in the episode, is Paul practices what he preaches and in terms of Paul's an active investor and a passive investor. So he's bringing the experience of both sides of a syndication to serving you and your needs as a borrower. He's seen it all from all sides in these deals. So not to plug Paul too much here, we're obviously fans and believers, but that's one of the things I think that makes you most unique in this space is your experience as an actual investor.
Yeah, I've walked that path. I've been in that seat. So there's certainly a different level of understanding and I would say empathy for my clients, having been there before. I understand how stressful deals can be in those 60-90 days from going under contract to closing. There's a lot going on. And so, you know, and hopefully that perspective, I can add insight, or I don't have all the answers. I'll be the first to admit that, but hopefully I have at least more experience than just on the debt.
Well, you know where to go to get the answers, right, that you don't have. Right.
Sure.
That's resourcefulness. That's what you got to have as an entrepreneur in general. So just a couple last things. We haven't talked a whole lot about mindset. You did just touch on it a little bit. I love that Kaizen, continuous improvement. That really resonates with me. I'm a big mindset guy. I spend a lot of time and intention on it, and am constantly learning and, you know, sponging up motivation and you know, high level discussion and concepts and ideas. And what you know, is there a particular book, particular, not guru, but a particular mentor, maybe, so to speak, that has really informed your career, the road that you've taken in this multifamily space?
I think I've tried to expose myself to a lot of different information and people. I don't know that there's any one that would stand out. I mentioned podcasts. I've listened to a lot of podcasts. I've been fortunate to be on a few podcasts, and I think there's so much information to glean, mm-hmm, there. I do like to read. As far as anything in particular, I don't know if this encompasses, I know it doesn't necessarily encompass my whole career, but it's top of mind. And that's The Miracle Morning. I think a lot of people have heard that or mm-hmm, been familiar with that. Hal Elrod wrote that book. He's been on a lot of podcasts as, yep, well.
Yeah.
I dabbled with it with good results and got lazy a couple years ago and had the fire stoked a little bit over the last couple months. And nice. I've been re-engaging, and nice, it's really beneficial. Like, there's so much to be gained from that. And I'm very committed to it currently. I'm seeing nice results from that. There's several Miracle Morning books. The Miracle Morning for Entrepreneurs.
Yep.
I've read the original by Hal, but the one for entrepreneurs is great.
It's a great fantastic audio book too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not just about getting up at 5 and doing affirmations. There's a lot of entrepreneurial advice in there as well.
Absolutely.
That's helpful.
Yeah. I got to see Hal Elrod speak this summer at a conference, and man, guys, Miracle Morning is definitely one to put at the top of your list if you haven't read it or listened to it. I love it on audiobook. The Miracle Equation is his other book. It's something that I try to really be present with on a daily basis. Unwavering faith and extraordinary effort equals miracles. That's the Miracle Equation right there. But those two books are awesome. Hal Elrod's amazing. And you can do searches on YouTube for keynote speeches that he's given. And yeah, that's an awesome one, Paul. Good call. Well, John, any last questions for Mr. Winter Road?
No, I mean, I think that was the only thing I was going to ask is, you know, what personal habits have contributed to your business success? And I think the Miracle Morning, I think getting up, the simple thing of getting up earlier, sometimes your habits feed your success almost entirely. And so, you know, something as simple as that, as getting up early, I think it's so powerful.
Yeah,
you're basically getting a head start on your competition.
Yeah, you've done a handful of great things for your own personal success, and I'm done with that before I used to be getting up. So, I mean, how can you not be ready to hit the day?
Yeah, they say if you win the morning, you win the day, right?
Yeah.
If you don't win the morning, it's pretty tough to win the day.
Yeah.
So, well, Paul, this has been amazing. We're super
my
grateful.
Pleasure.
Yeah, yes, thank you very much.
This is we're just getting this thing off the ground, as you know, and to bring on a powerhouse like you is awesome for us, and we're very appreciative. Well, Paul,
let's do it again down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll be taking you up on that for sure. If people want to reach you and learn more about you and kind of what you do and about Bonneville Multifamily Capital in particular.
We made our website a little tricky to find. It's six letters, BMF for Bonneville Multifamily CAP, short for capital. So BMFCAP.com is our website. Posted a lot of articles there. If you email me directly, just paul@bmfcap.com. I will add you to my newsletter, and I'm currently building my own personal website. It'll have blog and article there. But
you're on LinkedIn?
Email, I'm on LinkedIn.
And Facebook?
Facebook.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cool.
So
great.
Let's connect.
Awesome. Yeah, call Paul with any questions, and he's going to be doing all my underwriting now, so I don't know if he's going to have a whole lot of time, but we're pretty excited about that. Anyway, Paul, thanks again, and guys, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to The Apartment Guys. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play to get new weekly episodes and to drop us a review. For more, please follow us on Instagram and Facebook or visit our website at apartmentguyspodcast.com. Until next time, take massive action steps and rock on.